My name is Walt Wadeen, and this is the session on Thought for Food, Global Issues. And I am going to use some slides because I want to illustrate some points with some facts. And but even though we'll just keep talking and we'll have some figures up here and we can talk about those. I guess what I'd like to ask about first, when we say the words thought for food, global issues, name off some things you think about. What comes to mind? A global issue on thought for food.
Starvation.
Starvation.
Distribution.
Starvation. So, well, I heard that twice. Distribution.
Change of climate.
Okay.
Farming methods.
Right. Water. Okay. Water. Okay, I've got a slide on that, right?
Weather.
Weather.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Technology.
It's a country because normally it's food for thought.
Yes.
Turn it around.
Well, I was talking to David Wee last weekend about this, and I went through this before, and I called it humankind and food, and I didn't want to say those words, and so we were talking about, and Dave was the one that said, well, how about thought for food? And I thought, I like that. Well, good. I'm sure all of those will come up as we go through this. And if the person closest to the projector, can you turn that switch ahead that's on the back? Just push it ahead. You see up on top? That's it.
Would you like any more grapes?
Wait a while, what happened? There we go. I went backwards. yes. Okay. Where we're coming from here when we talk about this issue, and any comment, any question at any time is welcome, please. Because this is such a big, big issue that, my goodness, we aren't going to cover it all anyhow. So if you have some thought, please raise your hand or just pipe up and we'll talk about it. But here I'm talking about my background is mostly in the biological area, and so if we talk about developing the physical and biological resources that we have, there are other components that are really left out of this that I'm not very competent to discuss, sociological factors, religious factors, so on and so forth. So in some respects this is limited, but this is big enough for one discussion, for sure. Now, some of the issues that you have when you start talking about physical and biological resources, agricultural production, and that was mentioned here, the water resources was mentioned. How about the forests? Are we denuding the forests around the world, which causes soil erosion and so forth? Climate, definitely. Climate, atmosphere, weather. The genetic resources, and the other two times we met this week we were talking about the various grains and the staples, the starchy staple, more on the basis of crop and animals. And of course in the bottom is where's the energy going to come from to propel this production that we need. Now there is, on several of my slides you'll see reference to a Global 2000 report. This is a report that came out, well, it's 15 years ago or so, and a very extensive report that nailed down many of the issues at that point in time, and they're still quite relevant. Physical resources, land or soil, no question about it, or in water. Now we could have food from the sea produced in the water. Air is the carbon dioxide which drives photosynthesis to produce vegetation. Very, very important, minerals and energy. So those are factors that, now if you talk about the biological ones, then all this greenery that we have around here is really boils down to the cardinal, well, doesn't boil down to it, but the primary cardinal growth factors in plant growth are light, temperature, and moisture. And right now that's in pretty good shape around here. when you walk up to Hard Lake, you can see what happens when you go to Hard Lake and you get in that one dense, where the trees are quite dense or tall. Light limits, there isn't any ground vegetation down there whatsoever. So light's a limiting factor for plant growth at the ground surface out in that situation. But generally, these factors are good right now. Last year, when Carol, my wife, and I were here, moisture was limiting around here. It was difficult. The grass, I don't think, was growing at all. And then nutrients, germplasm, which refers to, do you have the plants, do you have the animals that you need to have a productive system? And then the production inputs. And this can be discussed quite a bit. On a global basis, are fertilizers available or shouldn't they be used? Are herbicides available or shouldn't they be used? Pesticides, shouldn't they be or should they shouldn't be used? How much, and so on and so forth. So those are things that are all within the realm of the biology. And what we've been trying to think about is sort of in a flow for this consideration. This slide predates my time at Holden, and so if we redid it, we'd say food for humankind rather than food for man. But land, water, with air, gives us vegetation, and then for food to humankind, you can either shunt directly from vegetation with the cereals and the many, many types of foods we have, or through animals, and then to humankind. I have a slide later on that will indicate what proportion of we get. In fact, it's right here. If you take the over the world as a whole, where does humankind get the energy from? Well, the big one are the grains. And we talked in previous settings here this week about rice and wheat and maize. These are really huge, you know, and they're very, very important. So you total all those up, 55%. The legumes, the beans, peas, lentils, and soybeans, 13%. So there you've got 68% right there of the energy that we need. It turns out that the grains are largely lacking in two of the amino acids that are important in building blocks, as building blocks in proteins, lysine and methionine. And the beans or the legumes supplement that so that if you can have a pretty good diet with that. Meat, milk, eggs, fish, fats and oils, 18%, and then what I was calling yesterday potatoes, the starchy staples, cassava potatoes, and so on and so forth. In here we maybe put something like peanuts, even though peanuts per se is not it's called a nut. But these are little biological technicalities. So if you kind of keep that in mind. And I want you to notice this one here. This would be one fifth of our energy needs are coming from this area. Many times you say, well, if we would eliminate, if animals could be eliminated, maybe we'd gain a tremendous amount. The other one of the big questions comes up to say, well, how about up in here? If we didn't feed all of this grain to animals, and try to come this route, we'd save enough up here so that we could feed a lot more people. That's true, but then what Marvin mentioned was the distribution is really difficult. To get the grain that we raise to the people that need the grain, it isn't simply done. I'm not rejecting it as a good thing to discuss, but it's not simply done.
Well, these are worldwide figures.
Yeah, those are worldwide. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you take a look at worldwide, and here, this is out of a publication that talks about the various areas. The most productive zone for crop production and food production is this one going through here. It's labeled as number 3. This is a zone where all the factors fit together: the land, the climate, the level of as people understand it, you can see here, you'd have the Corn Belt of the United States and this productive part of Europe, and getting into the Soviet Union on off from China and picking up and the north side of Japan. And so it's not completely accurate. This one gets to be a little bit warmer and it has some limitations. This one's a tough one. This is tough because you come across the central part of the world. It's a tougher job to get the food production. But Chris, that works in Malaysia, help me spot that.
About right there.
Yeah. Okay.
A little lower. That's
this Malaysia?
No, that's Sumatra. Just above. Whoops. Go back. Right there.
Okay.
Yeah. From there on down to the tip.
Okay.
That's Singapore thing.
Yeah, and you were saying yesterday that there they grow, you could grow three crops a year, almost. Three. In other words, you could grow one set and harvest that out, come back and get another one for sure, and maybe even three. Is that right?
Yeah. Three or four.
But
depends on what you're raising.
Right.
Depends on what the crop.
Can you give an example of ones, would they raise the same one three times?
Oh, no. Because they rotate.
Yeah, right. We were talking about that last time.
Crop rotation. But something like paddy, wet paddy, which is rice. Rice is actually what you eat. Paddy is the raw rice in the field, right? Normally they'll have just two crops a year because that takes quite a while from the time you plant it to the time you harvest it. But your vegetables that you have from your gardens that grow in a very short period of time, like your beans and so on, you can get three or four crops a year easily.
Mm-hmm. So there's maybe some other limiting factor, of course, much denser population, and so there's always a need. And so that would be within this area that I call tough. It has more possibilities, but it's also a difficult area. Now, if we take the world and we break it down into these statistics here, compare the world to the U.S., and the big important one, of course, is cropland. Where can you raise these crops? Well, it turns out in the world, about one out of every 10 acres would be cropland. Guess what? In the U.S., about one out of five. So we're very, very fortunate in the United States. That's just the way it is. We're very fortunate in the United States because we have an extensive amount of cropland. If you look here, it's quite the same, grassland, pasture, and range. Not too much different on forest land. There's a difference. And so the fact that we have all this cropland in the United States, we're really blessed in that regard. And so the total in millions of hectares is not significant to talk about, but so the cropland in the United States, 13%, we have about 13% of the cropland of the world, we have about 5% of the land. So we are truly blessed with that. Okay, so here's just a shot taken. This is a good soil. Let's start with land. This is a good soil. It's an Iowa soil in pretty good shape. It's dark, not dark, but it has the higher organic matter, which is reflected in the color. It's a little bit darker color. It's not as sand. Some of these soils, if you walk up towards the ballpark here along the path, it's quite sandy and would be difficult. And there's some, so this one's could be ready for planting. Now this soil, this is a shot I took in northern Minnesota some years ago. This is marginal. This is really marginal for cropland. But there's a fence around that field. So you see the early farmers would have farmed that. But it's not productive enough, or it's not economic enough to maybe farm that. Maybe it could be used for pasture. So you can see those extremes. And if you, here's on good Iowa land. How about the crops? Here's a shot taken in western Iowa with a crop of sorghum. These three young boys were at a field day. I took a shot of them. I like to see those guys. So this is on good land. On that land, you could also put it into a close growing crop. And this happens to be crown vetch, which I put this in here on purpose to show you that in the 1930s and 40s, they wanted to plant corn on all these hills, so they terraced it. This is a terrace. So the land was formed into terraces. And here's this terrace comes around here and go here. It's on the contour. It goes back around the hill. So the terrace, when the water comes down, it'll go into this and gradually work its way down. There's a small drop on that, so that it takes the water off gently off the slope. But that also became uneconomic to grow corn on there. And so now it's going back into forage crops and grasses. And this is a shot, I just put in one that I had with me. This is a shot of just to show animal production in parts of the world. This is a shot in South Korea. And I put this in here for a purpose because when I went to Korea several times, I found out that they had made the decision that they would grow rice on all of the land that was suitable for rice. Period. That's it. On the hillier lands, we will put it into grass. This happens to be back in a lot. These are cattle that were being raised out on the hills, and they were just happened to be in this yard and getting some type of a supplement at that time, a mineral supplement. And the interesting thing about this was that in the what do you call the Korean noodles that you can buy in the supermarket? The
ramen noodles?
Yeah, I think so. But you see, they, to supplement those into or to fortify those into a little bit higher quality with a better balanced protein, they were raising animals and then via the meat to phase that in with the noodles, so you could buy that kind of a noodle. You'd get a more complete than just a cereal-based noodle. That was the program, that was a government program that they were trying to push. And then, to illustrate, here is a grazed land with sheep on it in England, southern England, in a rather stabilized agricultural system that's been there for a long time, which includes animal. And so you get all these extremes when you think of crops, of land, of crops, of types that you have around the world. Now, just a few more, and then we'll leave it, because a point needs to be made, and that is that out of the Food and Agriculture Organization yearbook of 1975, if you look it up, you find out that a tremendous number of swine and chickens are raised in the world. And the fact is that when we raise swine and chickens, they compete directly with humankind for the use of the grain, because they need the grain, because they're monogastric animals. They have only one stomach, just like we do. So they have to have a diet of, if they have grain, they need the supplements. Now the ruminants, the four-stomach animals that I showed you, the livestock, including the deer out here that was eating in the daisies tonight. I couldn't eat daisies and exist too long, but I think those deer apparently get along quite well. So they have four stomachs and they digest this cellulose. That's basically it. You know, they chew their cud, and I don't know if a deer chews a cud or not, but they get it down into the first stomach and then they bring it back up and masticate it some more, and then it goes into the digestive system. And so they're taking the grass and the hay and the forage and all of that and making it into something we can use. Now, swine or pigs or chickens, they like to be out on the range too, but they can't really make it out there. So, how about the ruminants worldwide? Well, there are a tremendous number on the world basis. Millions of head of cattle, buffalo, sheep, and goats. And others, camels, llamas, alpacas, yak, and reindeer, and wild ruminants. That's some of the ones we had out here tonight, and more than 200 million. So there's a tremendous number of these, when we're talking about world food, animals that make a contribution to the food supply of these countries.
What are the two columns on the right at the top?
Yeah, there's an error. That column that says number, that means nothing. It's just in there an error. The other is animal units. It just tries to put them on some kind of an equal basis. if you take a think of enamel units, what happens there is you see this one gets reduced down a lot because of the sheep. A standard animal unit is like a 1,000-pound animal for a year. Well, about 12 sheep equal 1,000-pound animal. That's what the deal is. Okay, and then these animals provide other products than meat and milk: fiber skins, inedible products. They provide traction of power. The waste from them is utilizable in compost systems. And on. Now the next slide will show that some examples of these animals on a world basis. 20% of the world's population depends on animals for cartage, in other words, for power, to just pull things around. Water buffalo still work in the rice paddies, right, Chris?
Right.
By a few of them.
Lots of them.
And have they replaced them with the little tractors? I know in Japan, or that's... No?
Not so much in Malaysia. It's all water buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Look like the ones in, the wild ones that you see in Africa, they're so dangerous. Water buffalo there.
Yes.
And of course, these are docile, domestic, and very friendly.
So they're both domesticated and wild, both, depending.
And then they eat them too. If you care to eat one after it's served out its life's purpose, you know, it's pulled a cart or a plow for 20 years, I tell you, I've eaten a few, and I'd rather eat my Birkenstocks. They'd be better, because that's how tough they are.
Is it boiled or cooked or roasted?
That's not the only way you can do it, is just boil it for hours.
Is that right?
Yes.
And of course, that animal didn't eat any grain whatsoever. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, 75 to 90% of the power use in many countries of the world. In other words, that relates to the first one. 40% of the world's farmers use animal waste to enhance fertility. So there's a real organic system that's going.
What did that second one mean?
This one really means that they move a lot of produce around. This one is, I think, the one that relates to the pulling or working in the rice paddies, or maybe there are places yet that they turn wheels.
Water wheels.
In irrigation systems. In other words, you got a big wheel going and to provide the power which pushes the water up. And methane from manure has 71% of the energy value of natural gas. Well, this is well known, and of course, this is a rather interesting one. I don't want to get into discussion of it, but there have been some people saying that these ruminants in this country have to go because of methane that they're releasing into the atmosphere, either burping or from the other end of the animal, is affecting the global warming and all that. So, but that's. Most people I know say it's minimal. We maybe get more methane coming off of wetlands and so forth than you do from the livestock. And I don't have those facts figures, but okay. Let's go through some slides that kind of address and what some of these issues are. If you're thinking about the physical and biological resources, well, land loss and abuse is one of the first ones that's really. When it's sort of like, I guess it was Theodore Roosevelt said that, buy land, God's not making anymore, or something like that. You know, this is kind of the way it is. If it's ruined, it's gone, we just aren't going to have anymore. So soil erosion will ruin and take it out of production. Nutrient loss from land, that can be replaced. Soil compaction is difficult, but it can maybe be remedied. And salinization and desertification. Salinization is what occurs under irrigation. And the salts gradually come up to the surface, and the soil becomes saline, and then it's unproductive. And it's interesting, in biblical times or before that barley and wheat were supposed to have been domesticated at approximately the same time, and wheat was the preferred grain because of the gluten content in the grain, you could make bread from it, and barley was more of a, you could make meal out of it and eat it, but it didn't make good bread, But after the soils in the, let's say in the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley, after they had become salinized from irrigation, that wheat kind of wasn't very productive, barley came in. Barley could take it a little bit farther. And then if it gets really badly salinized, of course, then it's out of production. And so there are a lot of those soils that's exactly what happened. Desertification has gone on since time immemorial, and in other words, it just gradually, for various reasons, it just becomes unproductive. The desert just sort of is encroaching on the cropland. Okay, now this one is about U.S., but it's maybe something we can appreciate more. Tomorrow I'm going to be talking about alternative agriculture in the United States, and so we might put this slide in again tomorrow. But what's happened in the U.S. is the prime land, a lot of it, about 125 million acres in this country that is really the best farming land, has, and some of it wasn't pasture and range, it's been pulled out of pasture and range and put into cropland. In other words, the best land has been moved into cropland. There isn't any great reserve of the best land. It's all out there in cropland right now. Soil erosion, 50% of 335 million acres of harvested cropland in 1975 was subject to moderate, severe, or very severe erosion. And the average of all this at that time was 9 tons per acre loss, when 5 tons per acre loss of soil is acceptable. The United States Department of Agriculture Soil Conservation Service allows or said 5 tons per acre per year of soil loss is acceptable. And a lot of people say, well, why is any amount tolerated of loss? And you know, that's a good question. But they say, well, you could say, because if you calculate a 5-ton loss every year for 50 years, you could lose a lot of the good topsoil. And if you only have 6 or 7 inches of good topsoil, and you know, it's gone, you know, half of it's gone 50 years, and a figure you can kind of think about would be that you wouldn't create another inch of soil, nature wouldn't create you another inch of soil in less than 150 or 200 years. So you see, if that's allowed to continue. Now this is a low figure in some of the areas. In fact, I was just reading a book this afternoon that one of the people here that when we talked about last week gave me a book, and they were talking about the Palouse region of eastern Washington where the wheat is grown, and some of you Washington folks can either substantiate this or deny it. In the Palouse region of eastern Washington, that some of that was losing 30-40 ton per acre per year of soil loss. And whether you argue or not, to say, well, it's just being displaced, it's not lost, it doesn't end up down someplace else in the delta, it maybe moves on to some other people's place where they can farm it. That's what's always they say about wind erosion. It blows off of mine, but it's over there in Indiana. It blows out of Iowa, and it's over in Illinois now, you know, in Indiana. Except during the Dust Bowl in the 30s, when the dust got so bad from the Dust Bowl that it appeared in clouds over New York City and Washington, D.C., and then, you know, hey, you know, we don't like this. Another thing that is kind of alarming, and I would need to substantiate that figure, but it's hard for me to believe that, but whether we are losing 2.9 million acres per year of usable land into supermarkets, the parking lots, you name it.
If you live around here, you should be in Washington, I'm sure feel it.
Yeah.
On the other side of these mountains,
is that right?
You better believe it.
Okay, it's alarming, and just calculate that out a while. Now, one point that might be made here, and it was rather interesting, having lived in Iowa for many years, and there's quite a fuss about whether a Walmart coming into a town and taking a big area was a benefit to a community or a non-benefit. You know, more jobs, and so on and so forth. And there's a professor at Iowa State University in agricultural economics that calculated all this out, and he began to say, you know, it could be negative. There are a lot of negative things about this. And well, then they Walmart, of course, they had other economists that could go out, they could have a debate, you know, and have a good academic debate about this. There's pros and cons of this. Well, it turned out that in Carroll, Iowa, which is west of Des Moines, straight west in west central Iowa, and I suppose it's 30,000-40,000 people, well, that's not that big, 10 town. Yay. We'll open up this downtown and build it there. And I guess that's what finally happened. Now, I haven't been through Carroll. I used to go through Carroll, Iowa a lot, but I haven't been through there. But that's what happened. Well, in other words.
I thought you were going to change that slide.
Yeah. Did you have a question about
before
it?
Before you change that
sure.
slide, yeah. That 2.9
yes.
on the bottom, is that of the 335 in the second part?
No, it doesn't come. And when they say usable land, it maybe isn't coming out of cropland. It could be coming out of grassland and range. So it's maybe, but let's double this. Let's double it up to 600 million and then put 3 out of that. I mean, it's just crazy. If you had 600 and divide by 3, what, you got 200 years? You'd run out of land. It'd be all in parking lots. I mean, that's kind of a wild extrapolation, but I mean, it's thought for food, or food for thought. Okay, how about water? Somebody mentioned water before. This and the Global 2000 report deals a lot with that. And the big word in Washington now in agriculture, at least, is water quality, water quality, water quality. Okay, now we're just talking water. The Global 2000 report talked about 200 to 300% increase in world water withdrawals from 1975 to 2000. In other words, everybody's using more water. And one place I read that in the Nile River, which has had the same amount of water flowing through it for eons of time, there are 11 different countries or civilizations or something that are drawing on this, and there isn't any more water. So as population goes up, if everybody uses more and you have a bigger population, there's going to be a crunch after a while. Irrigation accounted for 70% of human uses in 1967, expected to double by 2000. So, much of the increased demand for water is in the lesser developed countries of Africa, South Asia, Middle East, and Latin America. Well, there are more people that are being born. Water supply is destabilized as forests are lost. That, we know that. Industrialization demand is increasing. So this is a Global 2000 report that wasn't very optimistic about water for the future. Climate. Sulfur dioxide, air quality, other particulates, nitrogen dioxide, and carbon monoxide. These levels exceed the World Health Organization safe levels in many cases. Acid rain, rainfall pH, if it drops from 5.7 to just less than 4.5, you have acid rain. So that goes on, and acid rain it can, they say that what's happening in southern Poland and industrial, it just lifted up higher with higher smokestacks and it affects Scandinavia, the forests of Scandinavia. Carbon dioxide increase, 15% in the last century, expected to be one-third higher than pre-industrial levels. Well, these are the worst, these are the upper levels. We could find cases where people maybe question these, but the Global 2000 report talked about ozone depletion, allowing ultraviolet light to increase. So that was all on that. How about the plant animal genetic resources? It's said to have 10 million species on Earth, estimated, and when this was written, they said it might lose 15 to 20% of those by 2000. Now I haven't read the book, but there's a book been written by two scholars out east that are questioning these figures. In other words, how many of these have gone extinct? Really seriously questioning these. So the upper figure, we might back off of that, but it still is a concern. And this is occurring because clearing and degradation of tropical forests, the water quality in the freshwater ecosystems, and food and feed grain diverse germplasm. We talked about earlier this week, particularly here, the genetic base on the hybrid corn which is grown and that of rice which is grown has been narrowed down. See, in olden times, every country every country had what they call land races of certain types of animals and of plants, of crops. And those have sort of gone by the board in many cases in favor of these higher yielding ones that have been put together and used. And as we talked about, for example, on the rices that have been bred, they started out with IR8. IR-8 was a rice that was the miracle rice, and they backed off from calling it a miracle rice. Now they're up to IR-36, and they're working, I don't know, they're maybe up over 100. So in other words, the rices that are being bred and worked on are one step ahead of the way the pests change to attack the rice. You follow me? And one professor that I know very well at Iowa State's good friend has an oats crop, has been talking about this for some years. He said that we can't have we have to have what we call a multi-line oats. In other words, in the breeding of it, you've got to have a broad base. It still has to be productive, but you have to have a broad genetic base within this oats so that, you know, if a rust mutates a little bit, it can't attack. It may be attacked in some way, but it's not going to take the crop. Well, in view of all that pessimism, maybe I'd go back and look in the, if they can study the Bible from the comic strips, which I've heard came up this week in Bible study. Here's some that I had. Ziggy? Is that Ziggy?
Yeah.
Yep. It's still in the funnies?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because these are some years ago. Okay, He says to the plant, you seem depressed. I just don't know what to do about you. I play all your favorite records. I read to you from your favorite book. I was a plant for the FBI. I let you stay up for every episode of Roots. I've arranged group sessions with nature lovers. I just don't know what else I can do. Plant says, some nitrogen would help. So, in other words, when we start thinking about how we're going to solve some of these problems or help, there may be some simple answers, but there are a lot of them that are very complex. So what I'd like to do in just a few slides is show you the International Agricultural Research Network, which has done a lot of very promising things and good things. Well, first of all, if you look at the coloring here, the light orange, it shows food deficit regions of the world. And you maybe would wonder about over in Europe. I'd sort of wonder whether it's deficit or not over there, but food exporting areas. So exporting from the United States, and that's maybe not as significant here as some of these centers I want to tell you about. This one is where Dr. Norman Borlaug worked in near Mexico City, CIMIC. That's Spanish for Centro Investigaciones Maize and Wheat. In other words, it was maize and corn, or maize and wheat working from there. CIP is the potato center in Peru. This is the area where potato originated, grows wild at the very high elevations up to 15,000 feet, and has been domesticated. So they have thousands and thousands of the potato lines that they've protected and keep there and keep working with them. CIA is in Colombia. This is another international center. ITA over in Nigeria is working with the grain legume or the legumes and others. ICRISAT in India works with the sorghums. IRI is the big one in the Philippines for rice. And so there's a set of these around the world in an international agricultural research network that have, the first one really was here, has maybe about a 40 or 50 year history. Rockefeller Foundation was very instrumental in starting that. Then the Ford Foundation teamed together to get the one started in the Philippines. And they work with the major field crops, rice, wheat, corn. You can see all the different ones. we talked about this one a little bit. This is a hybrid between wheat and rye that has never really gone anyplace very much. And you see all these others in animals, the ruminants, beef, and swine. So they work with those. And this is just some of the acronyms that we talked about. Well, now the philosophy or the way this operates would be that relating the International Center to a farmer in these countries, if you have the in these lesser developed countries, the farmers, if the International Centers work with institutions in developed countries, and the ones then can work with the national agricultural research systems in these lesser developed countries, and then through intermediates get to the farmers. So that's the way they feel it. The farmer at the top in these lesser developed countries is the one that's important. It's going to have something to do with food. So there are all kinds of mechanisms and systems by which they try to get this information out to these people. I think what I'll do is stop there. I have a couple more on relate to energy, but I'm not. If we have some time, we can talk a little bit about that. The main point on energy and is that. Well, let's go through. Let's just take a second. I think it's maybe obvious what is going on. Population. Has rural population zoomed up like this, but energy demand has gone like that. So it's sort of like the water situation. In other words, if everybody wants to use more water, more people, obviously the demand's going to be up tremendously. And energy is the same situation. And the tough thing is that the developed nations have used energy like this, and the developing nations are using a much smaller fraction. So that's really scary when you think about it. And so that's why any types of energy efficient systems that we can devise in this country that agriculture would use less would be of great value. Now, if you take proportionately speaking, in 77, this is a situation where you say, well, how could you look ahead and how could this energy pie be made up? And when this was drawn up, they said nuclear energy was giving very little back in 77, and it was projected to have that much. And I read recently that I think somebody said that you could never maybe count on the nuclear energy would provide as much as even projected there. Oil and gas, unconventional solar, coal, and hydro. The one that's come on strong and maybe isn't even represented here is, as somebody pointed out last week, it would be what we call biomass. In other words, you'd just be growing crops. So you would be growing a crop that could be harvested and compressed or whatever and uses energy. And as somebody pointed out last week, well, that's what our coal is. It's, you know, it's compressed crops of vegetation of eons ago, which is true.
What are some examples of these projected unconventional ones?
Well, that would be one of them. And I think at the time this was made up, they maybe didn't dare project too much. That would be one. In fact, tomorrow, one of the unconventional ones really is something like alfalfa. And let me tell you about that, as long as you've asked. Then I just heard about this 4 or 5 weeks ago. Alfalfa, or lucerne, was grown by the Romans. It originated in Persia. It's a legume, so it fixes nitrogen. It's an excellent quality forage to be fed to dairy cattle or whatever. Used in crop rotation, it fixes nitrogen so that you could go back to crop rotations. In fact, the Romans used it exactly for that purpose. So alfalfa is a really fantastic crop. And so they're looking for other uses for alfalfa. And I think I'm planning to use some slides tomorrow when I talk about alternative agriculture that kind of pull that out. But basically, if it's calculated out, alfalfa will grow you quite a bit of biomass that could be used. Another one that I worked with quite a bit, not for biomass, but it's, well, it has several other uses, was called wheat canary grass. It's grown in Scandinavia, and it's a grass which will tolerate, Judd, you know wheat canary grass from Iowa, when you were there? It's grown in low spots, and it can flood and come back and still persist. So it's used to stabilize road banks and various things. Well, it turns out that it can take a lot of nitrogen or sewage sludge to be put on. See, and so I've done several calculations for factories, for example, where they have a lot of wastewater that needs to be put out. It has high contents of this and that and so forth. So you grow the wheat canary grass and take it off and get it away from there. And then it doesn't go into the soil. And then in Scandinavia and Denmark, they are taking this wheat canary grass that's taken off and dry it down, compress it, put it into briquettes and burn it for energy, and checking what the emissions are, if they're okay. So this is all pretty exciting when you start to think of ways that could provide energy and take up some of these nitrates that have accumulated. In fact, there are some areas where nitrates have accumulated already that need to be cleaned up from the soil and the water. So energy is an important factor of the future. Let me ask if you've got questions before in fact, I expect we're getting close to that. We maybe have another 5 minutes or so. Rather than, Marvin.
Not really a question, but that first map that you had, I thought was a very interesting one, where you had the production areas of the world,
mm-hmm.
about the fourth slide. It would be really nice to see an overlay on that sometime about the population centers that would be matched up on that same kind of map.
Right.
Where we're looking at the distribution again, looking at where it's produced and where it's needed.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's what I will comment about, because I did want to, in relation to the world, forgot that I had this. Population is a big, huge issue. No question about it. In other words, Dr. Norman Borlaug, that got the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, in early 70s for his work with wheat, has said consistently, we've helped gain a little time, in other words, population is still kind of coming back behind you. And where it struck me is it's available in the bookstore, Vice President Al Gore's book on Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit, the Global Ecological Crisis. Well, I'd heard about this book, and I haven't read the book, but I've listened to the tapes. He has four cassettes that go with this. And he talks, one of the first issues that he talks about, well, he goes through a lot of different things. And what I thought I'd tell you about tonight is he's talking about, has anybody read this or listened to the tapes? Well, then this is a little book report I'm giving here, then, sort of a show and tell or something. But it really behooves us to listen to this, because I think that if you get the people alerted to some ways that we can help on this, he's talking about that what will need to be done is to mount a very strong plan, sort of like, and this is one of the good points in the tape, that he didn't say anything much political in there, except he said that he was a senator then, he wasn't vice president yet, but he when he talked about population, he talked a little bit about that he couldn't understand Bush's stand on abortion and so forth. But he did say that the Strategic Defense Initiative, which Reagan had promoted, had the elements of a way to attack the problem. And so what he's proposing is a strategic environmental initiative. and SEI. Okay? And that is going to have five main thrusts to it. And the first one, of course, is to get on the population. In other words, stabilize world population. And so that's a biggie. It is. You just hope that you can continue to grow enough food to help, but population will have to be curbed. And he points out in there that the major changes in the population, of course, are occurring in those very countries that are lesser developed. Okay, the other ones, and I thought it'd be good to have it maybe on the tape, where the second one was a rapid creation and development of appropriate technologies. Now, what do we mean there? What we mean is that if we go to help in another country from the United States, that the technology which we take to help with is appropriate for their situation. In other words, if they want a one plow tractor, we don't sell them a 10 plow tractor, right? A third was comprehensive and ubiquitous change in rules of the road, and that one I don't recall so well, but that had to do with how you calculate up and assess the benefits of from lesser developed countries with the developed countries. In other words, if you're getting some raw materials from them, are they getting the full credit they need from us? If we get raw materials from them. See, in other words, it's a sort of, and the fourth one, the negotiation and approval of international agreements, and the fifth one was cooperative plan for educating in the global environmental area. And I looked at the book briefly over at the bookstore, and I think what he had in the book were about 10 or 12 of these initiatives, and in the tapes he boiled it down to five. But population was first. And the other thing I think I have someplace, I don't have it here at Holden with me, is a slide that the one that showed the world. The countries are drawn in relation to population size rather than land area. And I think you've maybe seen those. And it's just scary. It's just scary when you think about it. Any other questions or comments? Yes?
What is the situation on the ozone now? You know, for several years back and so forth, they say, oh, it's deep cleaning, and we got to look out, boy, we're going to have a drought and the dry seasons and all that kind of stuff. We got to take precautions to stop depletion of the ozone. Do you know what the situation is on it anymore?
Not really. Maybe somebody else. Yes.
Well, all of the studies that have been done more recently have shown that it was worse than they thought it was going to be.
Well,
can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the amount of depletion is not just in the Antarctic, but across these latitudes in the northern hemisphere as well as the southern hemisphere. And as you showed, that's your world's crop production region, and this can sunburn plants like it can sunburn people.
And what steps are they suggesting that be taken?
It's a matter that all of the world's industrialized countries have agreed that they will quit manufacturing the products that were primarily responsible for depleting the ozone layer, which are things used now largely in air conditioning and have been used in foam plastics, but aren't being used there anymore, being used in fire extinguishers. And they're simply going to quit making them. First they said by 2000, then they said by 1998, now they say by 1996. No more produced in the world. But since it takes them 20 years to get up to the stratosphere where the ozone layer is, it will still keep getting worse, but not nearly as much worse as if we'd gone on the way we had been.
Yes, and Senator, or Vice President Gore commented on that in the tapes, and I was just looking for the notes when I was listening to the tapes. I don't find it right here, but he did address that. And so if you're interested, in the book, he talks about that. In other words, it's not good, but there's hope that, you know, some technologies. But the chlorofluorocarbon, isn't that it? The
ones that chlorofluorocarbon.
Yeah, those were the ones that had to be in the spray cans and stuff, and the air conditioning. But you see, to replace all that is a fantastic undertaking. Getting asbestos out of the buildings was maybe nothing compared to, you know, getting all that. Any other comments? Appreciate that. Comment. Yes?
I was looking at your nuclear chart there for 2020 with that great big piece of pie. It seems to me that it would take so much energy to take care of the waste for
right.
that amount of nuclear that just looks impossible to me.
Right. I think this, and again, I can't put it all together because I listened to those tapes since I came to Holden. I think it's on the tapes. Where they say that you can't look for that. It's going to be a smaller piece of the pie. In other words, either public acceptance or just the very factor you talked about is going to limit that. And then, of course, you've got other possibilities that maybe aren't, and I don't think it's unconventional, but some types of fission that I don't understand that are possibilities. No, I was quite impressed with this book. Our son, that's an ecologist, was the one that got the book, and I was really quite impressed with it. It's been criticized by some people, say, well, it's inaccurate. But I'll tell you, I don't think that book is inaccurate as some books are. That's my impression. I think he's coming at least in the tapes, he's coming at the, and it has to be elevated to some type of a concern where people can have an understanding. I believe that I'll call an end to the tape at this point, and I want to thank you all for coming and participating. If anybody wants to ask any further questions, we can go from there. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.